From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a local woman who seemed to have everything going for her. A great job, loving family, a wonderful daughter. But behind the scenes, this woman's life was in danger. Her partner was abusing her. She says he tracked her whereabouts, he kept her away from the people she loved, he threatened to kill her. Fortunately, she was able to escape the relationship and find support, but she says the stigma of being in an abusive relationship followed her. And now Keisha Carter is an advocate for domestic violence awareness, sharing her story publicly in an effort to help other victims and survivors. According to the CDC, 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men will experience physical violence by their intimate partner at some point during their lifetimes. The numbers are even more striking when you take race into account. The Women of Color Network reports 4 out of every 10 non-Hispanic black women have experienced either rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner. We've had a number of conversations about domestic violence on this program, the stigma surrounding it, efforts to support survivors, how to report it. Well, this hour we do a deep dive on another issue that has characterized domestic violence, race. Racial disparities in economics, education, and criminal justice contribute to the rates of domestic violence among people of color. Cultural factors also factor in to how and when victims may seek and get support. This hour, we discuss how racial disparities are really impacting the entire scene here. And I'm really glad we're having this conversation because Megan DeChateauvieux has brought this up on a number of occasions. She's the president and CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center. And I'm glad we're able to finally do this and to do it in person. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to be here with these community champions, too.
Also with us is Keisha Carter, Chief Diversity Officer for Coordinated Care Services, Inc. And Keisha here, as I mentioned, a little bit about her story. She'll tell more about that. It's an honor to meet you, and I'm just grateful that you're able to tell this story and help people. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Gina Cruz is the CEO of Heels of Greatness. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Gina, do me a favor. Grab that mic. Pull it really uncomfortably close to you. We're all getting used to being in studio together again. Tell people what Heels of Greatness is.
Heels of Greatness is a consulting agency. We also do a lot of training for domestic violence and workplace violence. We also get calls from outside of the agency regarding housing people for domestic violence. We also do that. So.
And George Payne is here, a case manager for Willow Domestic Violence Center. George, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, just a brief note from you off the top here. This is a conversation that's been sort of a long time coming. And, you know, you've been at Willow for a number of years now. Race isn't something that's always talked about in this context, but how much have you over the years grown to see how stark the difference is and some of the disparities?
So over the past year in particular with the pandemic, I think it's laid bare a lot of the disparities that we've seen in all kinds of social determinants. It's kind of brought us back to down to our knees in a lot of ways as a community, and understanding the different factors that contribute to someone's experience of domestic violence and their access to the resources and support that's available, and then the multiple ways that their lived experience impacts their outcomes and their safety levels and their interaction with the different systems in our community that are set up to support them. And sometimes those systems are more supportive to some and not to others. And we do see those breakdowns happening across racial lines. We do know that domestic violence impacts every demographic. It has no boundaries,
sure.
Right? So we know that it's in every part of our community, and yet we have an obligation and responsibility to really take a look at you know, whose house is on fire right now in the community? And do we all need to run there with our fire hoses and support people as they find safety and make sure that we're really addressing the most critical cases right now?
Well, I think Keisha's story is so important. And again, I'll just state as we turn to her to better understand it, there's a lot of people who struggle to talk about their story publicly. Why have you become someone who does this, who's willing to do that, and who sees the value in doing it this way?
Really for that exact reason, because there are so many people that struggle to talk about their story.
And understandably so.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think there was something about being able to help at least one person by being able to talk about my story, and for folks to see where I am now and where I came from and understand that and know that they're not alone, and know that what you see in somebody right in front of you may not be everything about them. And so I think for me, it really is about not just sitting back and being thankful and being proud that I am a survivor, but being able to reach back and help other folks be survivors as well.
Let's go back to when it happened. First of all, where's home for you originally? Where did you grow up?
Rochester, New York.
Right here.
Yes.
And this was, I mean, I think we're all young. We're as young as we'll ever be. But you were younger
yes.
when this happened. What was going on in your life?
From what people saw about me, I had everything. Like, I was happy. I was young. I was, and still am, gorgeous. but I was living a great life. I was going to work. I was hanging out with my friends. And behind the scenes, what people didn't see was that inside I was hurting. I had low self-esteem. I had grown up in a family where I didn't really fit in. And then I started looking for where I could fit in. I started looking for someone that could give me what I felt like was missing when I didn't really understand. For me, like now looking back, I realized what was missing was just, you know, the learning and development and growth within myself. But I looked externally for that. And those little things that started happening, you know, I was in this relationship, and the jealousy and the wanting to know my whereabouts all the time. I took that as, oh my gosh, he really, really cares about me. He loves me so much. He wants to be with me all the time. He doesn't want me to spend time with anybody else.
Did that happen right away in the relationship, or did that develop? No?
No, it happened. It happened slowly and with really small things, you know, one thing at a time, and then it grew and grew, and then it became... It changed from more of the emotional abuse where it turned into emotional abuse first, where I was told, you know, I was not pretty. I was not smart enough. I was not whatever enough.
He told you that?
Oh, absolutely. And I believed it. I believed it. I absolutely believed that nobody would want me but him.
How long had you been together at that point?
We had been together about a year.
So the early days of the relationship were
Oh, they were amazing.
Yeah.
They were amazing. But what I didn't realize was that it was all the prep work for what was to come, because it would be, you know, the small things like, you know, a small argument or a small disagreement. And I would feel bad, and then I would get a gift. And even though the gift, you know, at that time might have been small, I would get a gift. And then the arguments became more frequent. The put-downs in the arguments got harsher, and it was really that thought of, you know, saying things that he knew would hit below the belt, those things that he knew would tear me up inside.
That's tough when everybody in every relationship, you know, there's going to be disagreements at times, and everybody knows that we've got buttons that we could push or things that are weak spots. And probably everybody's had a moment where you go, I shouldn't have said that. But it's another thing when someone is intentionally, and you know that they are finding that and hitting you there every time. How did you deal with that?
At first, I bought into it. I believed that this was as good as it was going to get for me. He was gorgeous. He had, you know, so many things going for himself. He had a great personality. He was a charmer. Everybody liked him. And that I believed that that was as good as it was going to get for me. And then it got physical. And I found myself, you know, telling the most asinine stories, you know, about a black eye. Like, oh, yeah, I lifted the toilet seat up and I hit myself in the face with the toilet seat. I did this. I did, you know, it was always an excuse. And I started making more and more excuses for either hiding the physical things that people could see, or for not showing up to things that I would normally show up for. So I started making more and more excuses.
The first time he was physically violent, was it shocking? Because it's one thing to take those put downs and that verbal abuse, but for it to translate then in that way, what was that like?
Oh, there's been so many times. I'm trying to think about the first time. The first time it was shocking. And I remember telling myself, like, you don't have to stand for this. You're not going to take this. And then he came back. He apologized. I was gifted a bunch of things, and like it was this wonderful period of the next week or two, and everything was just sunshine and rainbows and butterflies, and it was amazing. And then it happened again, and you know, and then it was the apology, and then it became this whole cycle, and I kept staying because for a number of reasons, because I did feel like, okay, he's going to change, he wants to change. So there were things about him that made me feel like I wanted to stay. There were things about myself that made me feel like I wanted to stay. And I didn't feel like it was that bad. And it was, you know, this isn't that bad. He loves me. And, you know, it'll be okay. He's going to change. It's going to stop. And then it didn't. And it kept going for about a year more. And then I found out I was pregnant. And
then you found out you were pregnant. Yeah.
And even while I was pregnant, it continued. And
oh my God.
After I had my daughter, I had to make some decisions. And for me, it was the first thought was, do I want my daughter to grow up thinking this is okay? And whether I had a son or a daughter, that would be my thought. Would I want my child to grow up thinking this is okay? And so it wasn't immediate. It wasn't even that thought didn't make me say, all right, I'm packing my stuff. I'm out of here. It was, how do I get out of here now that I'm in it? How do I not be in it anymore? And that made me stay longer because I didn't know what to do.
Our guests in studio are going to have, I think, a lot to add here because everybody's story is slightly different. But what Keisha is describing, that fear of, even if I know I don't want my daughter to grow up with this, how? We'll get there in a moment here. But I want, as hard as it is to hear, I want people to really understand the scope of the abuse here. There was physical violence. There was verbal abuse. You said that you'd be driving in a car, and if you said something he didn't like, he would what? Threaten to crash the car?
He would threaten to crash the car and kill us both.
He would start, and what? Like start
speeding, yes. He would accelerate, he would start speeding and threaten to kill us both. And there were times even while he was driving, he would, you know, he'd reach over and hit me while he was driving if I said something that he didn't like. So it was, it became a normal, everyday part of my life. It was something that I thought about everything that I said. I thought about everything that I wore. I thought about everything that I did. I thought about my phone calls. I couldn't have phone calls in private. Because then he would suspect something and that would be a problem. So I thought about everything. My mind was constantly going. It never shut off. So
you talk about what you wore. Tell me about that.
Oh, it could be something as simple as jeans and a T-shirt, but I had to make sure my T-shirt wasn't too fitted. I had to make sure my jeans weren't too tight. I had to make sure that if we were walking into a store and someone else commented on how I looked or if somebody said hello to me, I had to make sure that, you know, I stayed silent because then it would be perceived by him that I was flirting with someone even when I didn't even proactively do anything.
And when you mentioned how much he wanted to control your life, if you weren't around him and he couldn't immediately get a hold of you, what did he do?
Oh, he would call everybody that we knew. He would look for me. He would drive to places that, to my friends' houses, to my mom's house. He would drive to places that he knew that I would frequently be. So he would try and find me any way that he could. Mm-hmm.
Did you talk to close friends or people you love, even privately, saying you cannot in a million years tell anybody, but I've got to talk to somebody about this?
I didn't reach out and talk to anybody, but my friends saw, because you know, there's only so much hiding of a black eye. There's only so much hiding of the bruises. Mm-hmm. I had hair falling out. I had either from stress and it was falling out, or I had hair pulled out, and so it was only so much that could be hidden. And so when my friends did bring it up, it was in a way that was an ultimatum. You leave him or we're not hanging out with you anymore. And
how'd you take that?
That was that was tough because, you know, I love my friends and I felt like they loved me. And there was still this thought of leave him in what, though? Like, right. So they had very, very good intentions. We were young and they had very good intentions. And knowing now, and I still talk to that same group of friends, and knowing now what we know that that was not the right way to handle that.
Were there people in your life who told you, well, this is just him being a man?
Absolutely. I had my sisters who, you know, that was just something that they felt like, you know, let, he's just being a man, you know, and every, the onus fell on me. Stop doing this. Stop saying that. Then maybe you should be, you know, you should be better at this. Do you cook for him? Do you make his plates? Do you do this? And so it became more about me. And so that I just shut down, and because that it didn't make sense to talk to them about it because that wasn't what I needed either.
I mean, you had to know deep down this is not you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I knew it wasn't me, and I knew I wanted better, but I didn't know how to get it.
And I don't mean to bring up like rough family history, but like, have you healed with your sisters over that? That's a hard thing to hear when you're being abused. That's just him being a man. What are you doing to bring it on? That's tough.
Mm-hmm. And I've healed with That's my good. Sisters. I've expressed myself. And again, I'm a very different person now than I was then. I've grown, I've developed, I've learned a lot. And that's another reason why I talk about my story, so that folks understand that, you know, there are some things that even though you want to say some things, you want to tell people, just get out of there, or you want to be on the other side, like my sisters, and you want to say, well, what are you doing to make this happen? For people to know that's not the right thing. And it's hard to let someone know, I'll be here for you in the way that you want me to be here for you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So your daughter was born. You had a lot of searching to do to figure out, even if I want to leave, I don't know how to do it. Ultimately, what did you do?
So I laugh when I think about what I started to do, because I happened to watch Oprah one day, and I didn't watch Oprah frequently. I didn't get to watch much TV, not because of him, just because I was working and taking care of a child. But I was watching Oprah one day, and there was somebody on talking about self-affirmations. And I remember looking at the screen like, yeah, right. Nobody. Like, you can't just tell yourself that you are whatever and you start believing that. And something kept nagging away at me saying, like, maybe you should try that. And I literally started trying self-affirmations. And I started with, you know, you are pretty enough, or you are smart enough, or you are something. I don't remember exactly which one it was, but I started with you are something enough. And the first time I said it, you know, I looked in the mirror and I'm like, you are whatever enough. Eh. And then I committed with that one time, I committed to doing it every single day. And by the end of like 2 or 3 weeks, it went from you are whatever enough to you are whatever, that fill in that blank, you are that enough. Yes, you are. And I started, like, I felt a change in myself. And then I started saying more. And I took it from one affirmation to two, and then three, and then four. And I would say these every day. And then I really, really believed it. And I was like, I'm done. I cannot. I don't know what's going to happen, but I cannot do this anymore. And I decided to let him know that we could, I'm done. But
in a conversation in person?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I was still smart. I called him. I was at work and I called him and let him know that this couldn't happen anymore and I was done. And he didn't take it well. He yelled, he was swearing, he screamed, and I'm like, I'm at work. I'm here with a lot of people. So I felt a little safer. Nothing happened while I was at work. I finished work. My daughter was at my mom's house, finished work, and got home that night. And none of my lights would come on in my house. And I was like, I know I paid my bill. I don't understand. And I had a three-bedroom. I lived in a three-bedroom ranch. And I was walking into my bedroom, which was across from the empty bedroom. And I normally kept that door closed because that was where I just threw everything that I didn't want to deal with at that time. And that door opened as I was walking into my bedroom. And before I even turned around, I knew. And I had this thought, I'm about to die. That's exactly what I thought. And when I turned around and I saw him, and he came at me with a knife, And over the next 5 hours, he held me hostage with a knife. He slit my throat. He tried to set me on fire. He pulled my hair out. He beat me. And finally, after 5 hours, and I tried to get out. I tried to climb out the window every time. You know, if he walked out the door or out the room, I tried to get out the window. If he heard the window, he'd run back in. And it was worse. And at one point, I heard him in another part of the house, and I tried to run to the front door. And I opened the door. He was right behind me, shut the door. And when I turned around, that's when he cut me shoulder to hip. And I fell to the floor. And when I fell to the floor, I thought, I have to do whatever I need to do to get out of here, because he's going to kill me, and then he's going to be in prison, and my daughter's not going to have either of us. And I won't let that happen. So I decided to give him what he wanted. And what he wanted was for me to tell him that we would be together. So I told him we would be together. We'll forget everything that happened in the last 5 hours, and we will be together. And he said, okay. And he thought this was it. And he immediately turned into a very different person. He was calm. He was caring. He was loving. And I kept thinking, I got to get out of my house. I got to call the police. And so I was able to get out. I called the police. And when the police came, and as we're talking about disparities, when the police came, and this is nothing against, you know, the police department or anyone, because, you know, I do believe that there's a lot of learning that has been done in the last 20 years. But two white police officers came, and I'm a black woman. Two white police officers came, and I am bleeding. I'm drenched in oil. I am bruised. I am just, I'm a shell of the person I am right now. And they let me know if they get another phone call. It was a simple domestic. If they get another phone call from this residence, be it a knife, a fork, or a spoon, they will come and arrest him. And I told them, if they get another phone call, it won't be from me. It will be from one of my friends or one of my family members telling them to come get my body. And the police officers left. So I decided to go. By this time, it was time for me to go back to work. So it was the next morning. I went to work. I worked at a grocery store, and I was the manager at a grocery store. So I had keys to the store. I went in earlier than I needed to be, and still bloody, still bruised, still drenched in oil. And when I got there, I called one of my girlfriends and told her that I needed to leave my car in the parking lot because he would come looking for me, and I needed her to come and get me, and we needed to go to the police station. And she came and got me. We went to the police station. I filled out a police report that took 12 pages because I had to write every single thing that happened. And the police sergeant, who at that time was a black woman, looked me square in my face and said, I need you to let me know if everything you have written down is true and honest. And I said, yes. And she said, hallelujah, because I was so hoping that you did not retract any of that. And she had me sign the statement, and she said, I'm going to arrest him myself. And that's when things completely changed for me, because I knew that I had done something I could not, and that was the thing. We had broken up before. We had broken up and gotten back together. This was a time where I knew I had done something that I could never come back from. And that was when my life completely changed for the better.
They arrested him?
They arrested him. He did not, I felt like, because the reason my lights would not come on when I went into my house was because he had taken out all of the light bulbs. So he didn't just shut the power, he had taken out all of the light bulbs. And so I felt like that was a completely different step. That was an extra step. And because it was, to me, it was premeditated. He should have been charged with attempted murder. He was not. He was charged with assault and menacing. So he got sentenced to a year in jail. And he got out, and he reached out to have visitation. And this is where I knew I was 1,000 times stronger than I had ever imagined myself to be in the last few years that we were together. When he reached out to have visitation with my daughter, I said yes. He just can't. We needed to find a third party, because at that point I knew it wasn't about her. It wasn't fair to her to keep her from her father. And it was the issues that we had were issues between him and I. And as long as he was going to be a father and be in her life, then I would allow that. I never wanted her to grow up with resentment and thinking and looking back, thinking, you know, if I hadn't kept her from him, her life might have been different. If I hadn't done this, her life might have been different. So I knew I was a way different person. I was stronger. I was better. I was an amazing person at that time. Like, and I had friends that were like, girl, are you crazy? I would not have let him, you know, it wasn't about me at that point. And he showed who he was. He never harmed my daughter, but he's not in her life right now. She's 24. He's not in her life right now. He, by his own choice. And he showed who he was. And
did he stay in her life for a while?
No. I would say 8 years max.
Okay.
And not even consistently. But she's an amazing person. She now knows. And the other part is when my daughter got old enough and she wanted to start dating, when she was 16, she wanted to start dating. Based on the rules in my house, she had to, you know, we had to have a conversation about that. And part of the conversation, I'm married to an amazing person. And my husband and I decided that was the time for her to know the full story. I'd never told her anything about her father and I, because I never wanted that to shape how she felt about him. I wanted her relationship to be with him what their relationship was going to be based on how they interacted. And when I told her at 16 years old, because she said she just figured we just broke up. Some people don't stay together. So when I told her everything, and I didn't hold anything back, when I told her everything about what had happened, she was silent. And this is the part where I normally don't cry when I talk about this until I get to this part, but she was silent for a while. And I told her, it's okay. I get that was a lot. That was really heavy. You got to process it. And then she kept being silent, and it scared me. And I said, you hate me now, don't you? And she looked at me, and she said, no, I could never hate you. I always thought you were the strongest person I have ever known. And now I feel like you are even stronger. And she came over, and she hugged me. And she told me that she loved that I made sure I could be here for her. And that, and to this day, my daughter and I are super close. And I think that because of that, because I was so honest with her at a time where I felt like she could handle it, my daughter is super honest with me. We talk about everything. And there is nothing that I don't feel like I can ever fail as a parent, because I've made it, and
you survived for her.
I did, and I'm so thankful that I did, because, like I said, I have an amazing husband. I have an amazing child. Thank you. I have an amazing life. I have, you know, and all of those affirmations. I still say affirmations to myself, and I know that I am stronger than anything that can ever come my way. And I think that is what other people need to know, that, you know, regardless of whatever their situation is at this particular time, you have strength. You have folks that have been there. You have folks that have made it. And you have someone that will just listen. You have someone that will sit with you and just let you cry, let you scream, whatever it is. You have that, and that is, and I have to give a lot of kudos to my husband, because we had known each other before I got out of that relationship. And then when I was out of that relationship, I was not ready for a relationship. And he was just an amazing friend. He came over, and he let me cry. He let me just be whatever I needed to be to start to heal and start to be the best me that I could be every day.
I thought I was ready for this story. I was not. Wow.
You know, every time I hear, Keisha, your story, it's incredible. And I just think the same thing that your daughter, you know, you are stronger and stronger and stronger every time I hear it. I think that how incredibly strong you are to have survived that and to be here today and to be sharing the story with so many people and inspiring others to find that strength in themselves. I don't think I've ever heard the piece about the affirmations before. I think that was something new today, and I love that. And I'm reflecting on those words that you shared, that you are enough. Mm-hmm. You are enough. That was that you are strong, you are worthy, and you are not alone. And I'm thinking about the words on the mural project that you were part of, and yes, how that's like a banner for the entire community and for survivors to see those words up there and to know the connection to you and your story.
Yes.
You are enough. You are amazing. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, absolutely. And for anybody listening, if anyone, just know that you are enough. Mm-hmm. You are, whatever it is that someone is telling you, you are not, you are enough.
Yes, and that you're not alone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, thank you for being a thriver, for sharing your story, and being able to just pour it out into the community. We really appreciate you and how you just pour out all this to the community.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so let's talk now, if we could, about, Keisha's powerful story included an important figure there, a police sergeant who was going to make sure that things changed. People sometimes take different paths. And let me ask all of you, I'll start with you, Megan. For people who unfortunately end up in a situation that may be similar to what Keisha is in, what do you want them to first think about and know when it comes to resources, when it comes to the safest possible way to proceed if they decide I've got to leave this?
Yeah, absolutely. Every situation is unique. Every story is unique. And yet we see, you know, over the many years of this work and the many calls that we receive, there are a lot of patterns that emerge. So some of the pieces of Keisha's story definitely translate into other survivor experience. And we know there's the honeymoon period. We know that there's the love and the vibrancy in the beginning, and then the emotional and verbal abuse. And it can just escalate into something that people find themselves in. We talk about often the experiment where you can put a frog in a pot of boiling water, mm-hmm. right? And it will jump out. But if you put a frog in cold water and turn the heat on, it stays. And I think that that's a similar experience that many survivors share. So the first thing that I would recommend people do is to call our hotline. So we have this 24/7 resource available to the community. The number is 222-SAFE. It's 222-7233. And I think there's a misconception out there that you have to be ready to leave, or you have to need shelter, or you have to have some plan in place before you call the hotline. But really, we are here for everyone just to have that moment to chat while you're at work. You can text us. You can call us when you're at home, you know, wherever you are at any time of day and night, to be able to kind of put those plans in place for yourself. So thinking about the components that might go into a safety plan as you're thinking about, okay, I need to leave, but how? What resources are out there? How do I do this? How do I plan for this? And you can talk with our advocates about a safety plan. And actually, you know, George would be the right one to answer this question, because he takes these calls day and night on the hotline and helps survivors walk through that experience.
George, can you elaborate on that experience and maybe what you want listeners to be thinking about?
So I'm listening to what I just heard, and that felt like a really sacred moment. Mm-hmm. It felt like you were bearing your soul to mm-hmm. us and sharing your truth. Thank you. Because I know that there are tens of thousands of people who are listening, and somebody's going to pick up the phone and call us because of what they just heard.
Amen.
And it might transform yes. their life, and Crazy. They might be sitting here someday telling their story.
Yes.
So that was absolutely extraordinary. Thank you. And I'm also thinking about what would have happened, you know, during the peak of this violence, when he had taken your relationships away, when he had terrorized you. I like to use that word, terror. This is interrelational terror. Domestic violence has not even come close to describing what we're talking about. Psychological, mental, financial, physical terror. And you finally were able to make that call. You found that space. You found that moment. You decided you were going to take that risk. And you call us. And somebody picks up, and they're not interested, or they're not going to listen, or they're going to tell you, why don't you just get an order of protection? Or why are you staying with him? Or why don't you just go into a shelter? Why don't you take your daughter and go out of county? what would have happened? You know, what would that experience have been like for you? So listening to you, I'm feeling the importance of the work that we do. It's resonating really strongly right now. We listen. We let you tell your story first. And then you tell us what you need. And then you tell us how we can help. And if we're not listening, we're not doing our job. Mm-hmm. And we have to listen actively, and we have to listen without shame or blame or judgment or questioning your motives or your intentions, because you are the expert of your life, and you are the one who's surviving every single day. That's just a 10, 15, 20, 30-minute phone call maybe that we have. That's just a little glimpse into your life. And I'm also just stunned that moment that you described when you were being tortured and your life was on the line and he had done those horrific things to you. What were you thinking about? You were thinking about your daughter. It's those kind of moments that remind me why I do this work. I've been doing it for 5 years and I've worked with over 1,000 survivors, and I hear one story like that and I want to work with 1,000 more. Because that's real. That is courage. We can put courage on a bumper sticker. We can talk about it all day long. Survivor, we can use these words. But when you hear that kind of story, that's what it means. And you survive for yourself, for your daughter, for your family, and for all of the people that are listening who need help right now. You survive for them. And I'm honored to be here with you.
And so, George, you know, you bring up, I think, something, I think, powerful for everybody listening who may ever need to make a phone call to someone like you, which is that they may call you at a different stage. You know, if Keisha had called you early on, even before there was physical violence, but when there was clearly abuse happening, she might have called and said, you know, I'm scared. I don't like the way this has gone. I don't know what to do. I need someone to listen. And she may say, I don't know what to do, but talk me through options. Or she may call you when her life has been, I mean, when she's worried about dying, and she's saying, I need the fastest way out of here for me and my daughter. And that's going to be a different situation. How much within reach are the various resources you need? Because if someone calls you and says, I need someone to talk to, that's different than my life is on the line for me and my daughter. I need to be out of here now. You know, I'm alone. He's out of town. I've got some time. I don't know what to do, versus I've got no time at all. All those situations are different. How much are you able to figure out what a person needs and act then?
Yeah, you explain it well. Absolutely. We are survivor-centered and we are solution-focused at Willow. So we meet the client where they're at. We ask questions, like I was saying before. When we are creating a safety plan, we are creating that safety plan. We don't know what safety means to you until you tell us. So it's important to hear from you, the survivor, what works for you right now. It may be a shelter. And if that's the case, then let's explore that option. There's out-of-county shelters, there's city shelters, there's domestic violence shelters. The abuse may be so severe that you need to get out of the state. That is a very advanced safety plan. We're going to have to figure out transportation, relocation, how you store your
items.
But
that happens.
It happens. It absolutely does. Mm-hmm. But it may be something as simple as changing your locks. It may be getting a phone that can't be tracked. So, yeah, the scope of the safety plan is wide ranging for sure. But what's most important is that the survivor is the one who's creating it. Because we cannot know what safety means until we have an understanding of what your options are. So when we talk about solution focus, that's exactly what we're talking about. We realize that the abuser, the person trying to do harm, has marginalized your life. When we're talking about marginalized survivors, in one real sense, every survivor is marginalized. Where you can go, who you can talk to, how much contact you can have with friends and family. All of that is about marginalization. So we have to work with what options are viable, where we can go, what's realistic, and we hear that from the survivor. It doesn't come from us. So these conversations can last an hour or more, and they can have follow-ups. That's really important too, right? So when can we talk again? Let's see what your situation looks like Wednesday. It's Monday now. A lot can happen in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. You're hearing what it takes to get through one day with an abuser who is intent on making your life hell. It takes a lot, right? So we realize the dynamics of abuse, and we understand that it's one step at a time. Those steps are walked by the survivor, and we're there as long as they want us to be on their side.
Amazing story. And Megan DeChateauvieu, as president and CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center, I'm so glad George is here.
Me too.
To let listeners know what it sounds like when you actually make this call. And because I'm, in a strange way, I'll say I'm almost comforted listening to George. I've never had to make this call. Mm-hmm. But the comfort that I feel is that there's not just one tool for this. Right. There's not just one solution. And now we've created something that you're ready to help people in a variety of ways. I know that was always the mission, and it's been, but I just, to me, there's a lot of comfort there.
Yeah, absolutely. George is one of our rock stars, and we're really, really lucky to have him on our team. We have an incredible group of advocates that answer that hotline call, and so anyone calling at any hour of the day or night will reach George or someone on his team that can really respond to their needs in the moment. Kind of circling back, too, to thinking about the work that we're all doing in this community to advance inclusion and equity. And at its heart, that work is person-centered. So recognizing the individual lived experience of each survivor, of each individual, for myself, as a cis white woman, I recognize my privilege in these spaces. I recognize, that I do not have the lived experience to fully understand or to know or to be any kind of expert on someone else's experience. And so at Willow, we really stand in the place of humility and understand that the survivor is the expert in their own life and their experience, and we stand ready to support them and walk with them.
What's the phone number?
222-SAFE. It's 222-7233.
Gina Cruz is the CEO of Hills. Keisha's story. Thank you for being a better host than I was there, Gina.
Well, as a survivor, I know where she's coming from, so being able to get her story out is very important in recognizing everything. What I do love is the fact that everything is not one way anymore. It's not the solution. We used to just do, it's this way, Now we can take that story, or like he said, when they call the hotline, it's a we, not I. I'm not going to tell you what to do or how to do it. I want to listen to what you're going to tell me and write that safety plan with you. Another thing I would say, when you're going into your beauty salon, barbershops, stories, are there, pay attention to those stories, because you as a beautician can save someone as well. I remember many stories. We done cut it out when we go out into the beauty salons and barbershops, and they say, wow, this information is very important for me to have, because if I have somebody coming in here, I need to give them Willow's number or Resolve or Heal or somebody in the community that they can talk to. So being able to have that information available for them, whether it's there or church or anywhere, just having that information and the resources is very crucial when you're dealing with survivors.
And meeting survivors where they are. So I love that you brought up the Cut It Out program, because that is so critical and pivotal to changing our community culture around DV as well. Like, being in the community, in the spaces where survivors are most likely to disclose. So we heard from Keisha, her first call was not to Willow. It was not to our hotline. It was to her friends. And so how can we be in those spaces with those friends or with teachers, coaches, hairdressers, all of the people in our community that survivors will talk to first? How do we ensure that they have the tools to respond in a way that doesn't shut the survivor down, that keeps that door open and helps them find the supports they need?
Yeah.
And just listening to how she said that when the police officer came there, they did nothing. I'm the president of SAFER. I'm Survivors Advocating for Effective Reform. And I remember a couple years, many years back, Chief Moore was a police officer, the chief at that time, was sat down at round tables trying to get codes and to find out what is going on in the community. How can we recognize calls that are going there? They were just using 999. That's it. So we developed a code to be able to recognize that this is a domestic violence call. Then how do we train now? So we started training police officers on how to address domestic violence calls, So being out there and being able not just to train police officers, but judges, lawyers, on how to deal with the situation at the time.
Is it better now? Nobody's saying it's ideal. Is it better now than when you started that work?
Domestic violence has increased, but the knowledge that is being put out there from, rather it's Willow, Resolve, Heal, or Safer, it's more informative, and the judges are now starting to know more information. So now we just got to keep it to the point that when a new one goes in, you know, mm-hmm. or a new lawyer goes in, or somebody goes in, that we, or even the police department, that we continue that training process.
And I want to read an email from a listener, Gina, because I think at the center of this is I want to keep centered the facts that women of color, particularly black women,
are higher, 30 to 50%.
They suffer more, mm-hmm. and they're believed by the system less. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes Keisha's story so hard to hear at times. I mean, everything was hard to hear. But my God, when you make that call to police, I don't think those two white officers showed up thinking, well, here's a black woman, and we don't like to help black women. There's a lot of, this is what we mean when we say implicit bias. We think, we did the right thing. We told her, hey, if we have to get called again. Meanwhile, the woman is, I mean, Keisha was bleeding out. I mean, you've been stabbed and attacked in multiple ways. And these officers might have thought they were doing the right thing, but it did not happen until there was a black woman, a police sergeant, who followed through and did what had to be done. So let me read this email from a listener who's asking for the same results for black women that white women and that the rest of society get. So the woman who emails is a black woman, and she says, listening to Keisha's story reminds me that black women who are victims of physical abuse, sexual abuse, or sexual harassment are not often supported in the same way as white women victims. Last week, Lakea Sinclair, a woman of color, shared her story as the only victim willing to come forward against Ernest Flagler Mitchell, mm-hmm. who has never even denied her accusations. Despite this, not as many people have publicly come forth in support of this woman, Lakea, virtually leading her to be harassed online. All victims should be supported and protected, all of them. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I totally agree. The same services are not available. And even not just black women, but also Latinas and LGBT community, it's the services are just not there. People are not believing them. We're supposed to wear this on our shoulders. One thing I love that Keisha mentioned before in the past is a piece of man is better than no piece of man at all. No man at all. You know what I'm saying? Those were the kinds of things that people were telling us. So we're supposed to be so strong, you know. So people portray us to be strong, you know. And when they portray us to be strong, that's not happening to her. She's a strong woman. That can't be happening to her.
Or you're a strong woman. You can just deal with that.
You could deal with that, you know. So having those services available and hearing that we do this, you know, safety plan, okay, that right there makes a big difference. Because to me, you can't tell somebody what to do, okay? You have to listen and be able to write that out with them, you know, to be able to take them to that safety place, that needed safety place. Her safe space is not my safe space.
Yeah.
Megan's safe space mm-hmm. is not mine, okay? And that's the other thing we're lacking, is a lot of a safe space where we're able to come together and be able to let go of everything that we're dealing with and talk about it.
Keisha, what would you say to the woman who emailed, who wants the same sort of societal outcomes and respect for black women when they make these claims, when they have the courage to come forward?
Absolutely. I would say I completely agree. Mm-hmm. And I would say that black women are over-sexualized in the media and in society, and perceived as, and young black women are perceived as older because of that over-sexualization. And I think that I agree with the emailer, and I think we need to share the resources that are available so that folks know what's there and identify the gaps and identify the spaces where we don't have those resources available. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I'm willing to work with you, emailer, to do something about getting those services into the spaces that where they don't exist.
So am I.
And what would you... Keisha want to leave with listeners who, you know, God forbid they're in the same situation or a similar situation, everybody's a little bit different, but feeling terrorized, I'm going to use George's word, which is the right word, abused and their life threatened, wondering if there's somewhere to go, what would you want to leave with them?
I would leave three things. One, Willow is available. You just heard from George. You just heard from Megan. Call Willow. Talk to someone there. If you feel like, you know, many of us, especially from Black and Latino families, have been taught you don't tell anybody your business. You know, listen, people know your business. Trust me. They know. They're laughing behind your back. They're not saying anything. If they know and they're not stepping up to help you, then, you know, you need to contact Willow. If you don't want to contact Willow, contact me. Find me on all social media. I don't have an I in my name. It is Keisha Carter. No I in my name. Contact me. Contact someone that you feel you can talk to who will meet you where you are and help you in the way that you want to be helped. I don't care who it is. Just call somebody. Talk to somebody. You do not have to do this all on your own. You do not have to have your mind going a million miles a minute worrying about what you can and can't do or say or be, where you can and can't be, whatever that is. You don't have to do this by yourself.
I am so grateful for all of you, for what you've all brought to this conversation and to this community. And Keisha Carter is the Chief Diversity Officer for Coordinated Care Services, but also sharing your story as a survivor, and I'm grateful to it.
Thank you.
Can I just add
also? Please do, Gina, yep.
I just want to add that also 275-HEAL is also another number that they are able to call. We collaborate with at the University of Rochester with Willow as well.
And it's a great resource.
275-HEAL,
H-E-A-L.
H-E-A-L. Thank you, Gina, for being here and for this insight. So powerful. And from Willow, one more time, Megan DeChateauvieux, the number to call there.
222-SAFE, 222-7233-247. We're here for you.
Thanks for being here. George Payne, thanks for the work you're doing for this community. I know it impacts a lot of people.
Thanks for creating this space today.
You got it. Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson, all saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.